I'm David Halpin, retired surgeon. But since I retired from surgery about 2005, I spent most of my time attempting to speak the truth. Because I don't like seeing people harmed, especially children.
Now, you've been involved in running, trying to run anyway, medicines and aid supplies to Gaza and to the Palestinians.
No, I did lead a voyage, the Dove and the Dolphin, on the 1st of February 2003 from Torquay, from Holden Quay, to Gaza. In fact, we couldn't get to Gaza because it's just a fishing quay, and the ship we chartered was too big for that, the SS Barbara. But you'll find a wonderful film showing the genocide in the Zionist entity was well in progress in 2003. The film shows genocide taking place then.
So were you still working as a doctor when you did that?
Yes, I was. I was then still operating, I think, at the Royal Dome in Exeter, doing mostly knee replacements for colleagues on their waiting lists, for their waiting lists. But I was also going around general practices, six in all, seeing people with orthopaedic problems, which I could often resolve in the GP surgery, saving people a long journey to Plymouth or Torquay.
So how did you resolve those?
How did I what?
How did you resolve them?
How does it all? Well, partly just by hearing the history, because the history gives you the diagnosis in two-thirds of cases. So if I was blind, I could still make a diagnosis in many cases. Some of them had conditions, tendon problems in the hand and things like that, carpal tunnel syndrome, which I could resolve with an injection of cortisone, and they could, within a few days, feel relief. That was quite common. But most often, I think, I made a diagnosis in the orthopaedic field. I like diagnosis. And once patients get told the diagnosis by someone who has engaged with them properly, listened to them, they're quite happy to go on with simple advice in trying to live with their condition. I find that's definite.
So this is almost at the heart of some of the problems with modern medicine,
yes,
in that you've got a pharmaceutical industry that actually would much rather that patients become dependent on their products.
Yes, exactly. Whereas, in fact, quite often it might be a question of weight reduction. If it's an arthritic hip, using a stick in the opposite hand, ladies didn't like doing that because it showed them to be a bit crippled. That was always resistance there. But the fact is that once people know the odds and told it in a clear way, they're often quite happy to continue. And regarding drugs, you might suggest a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, but they're dangerous drugs. So I used to say, if you need it, take it for just 2 or 3 days in short bursts, but don't take it chronically, continuously.
I think people hearing that to help a hip, you should have the stick in the opposite hand, yes, will be a bit bemused about that, because most of them will think, actually, the stick should be the same side that you've got the problem.
If it's the knee, it's the same side, but if it's the hip, it's the opposite side. I wasn't good on biomechanics, as it's called, but it was analysed, and that's the truth. Stick in the opposite hand for the poor hip.
So what about changes that there have been since you were actually working in hospitals,
right,
and in surgery up till now? It seems that quite a lot of we're hearing now about they're not even proper doctors doing diagnoses and this sort of thing. So there's been, I don't know if it's about, if you could call it a bonfire of the regulations, but it seems to be in a lot of changes. The idea that we haven't got enough doctors because we're not paying them enough, and so we're going to have to get nurses and these sorts of people to do their jobs for them. Even sometimes people at the DSS are doing a doctor's job.
There's a lot of that. There's a lot of so-called delegation. There's a lot of... the other night on Spotlight, they were interviewing doctors who were at the end of their tether because of the amount of work they were being asked to do. But I thought that the calibre of the people on, doctors, was low. They were talking about their clinical load, but a lot of that, of course, has been added to, I'd say about a third, from the adverse effects of the inoculations that they were promoting. unethically and criminally.
So you're talking about COVID jabs?
I'm talking about COVID jabs. There was no informed consent. That is unethical and it's criminal, particularly when you're talking about an experimental product which had not gone through third phase trials. Remember the American title for the rollout of the COVID vaccines, Warp Speed. That says it all. So I would say that the majority of doctors in this country have been guilty of gross professional misconduct.
But they're trying to keep their jobs, surely?
No, well, they're being told what to do. But things any proper doctor is able to say what is best for the patient. What is drilled into us, or should be drilled into us, is the Hippocratic Oath. It's shortened, but do no harm.
But they're people who are managing their practices were saying, well, we're not insured for that. We are insured for this.
Insured for what?
Well, so, for example, for the giving the jabs, not for giving some other sort of treatment.
They weren't insured for that. And the thing is, they're being defended in this by the General Medical Council, who've crucified doctors who've spoken the truth, like my friend, a surgeon, a very skilled general surgeon, particularly with a laparoscope, Mohammed Adil. Born in Pakistan, a Muslim by faith, and he's been targeted and crucified. He's had no income for 3.5 years. He was told to stop working when he was covering for sick colleagues up in Oldham, I remember. He was finishing a clinic in one of the four hospitals that he was attending. He was told to stop working in that hospital group during a clinic. He asked to see the medical director, since the order was meant to be coming from a doctor, and the medical director didn't have the moral courage to come to meet him in the manager's office. From that time on, he's had no employment in the health service, no income, and he's now almost destitute.
Well, we do hear, don't we, about the whistleblowing charters, but it seems that when people actually do come to blow the whistle, that they're treated like Dr. Adil. What about, there are certain obvious red lines, like, for example, a death certificate must be signed by a doctor.
Yes, well, that's different. That's changed since our legislature, the House of Commons, has passed. It meant to be with the sunlight clause. It's meant to be an end to it. It's meant to be discussed again after 2 or 3 years. But I understand that the certification for cremation and death certification has changed. And a dear friend, whose partner died yesterday, just over a day and a half ago, actually, the death certificate has been dealt with by a nurse from the hospice dealing with people who come to the end of their life. And the cremation certificate, I understand, can be partly signed by the funeral director. I think that's what she said. I can't believe it. It used to be two doctors. And as a young doctor, I had to sign, I don't know if it was part one or part two, I can't remember. But we had to see the corpse. And I was taught by a very good forensic pathologist I now know, a fellow called Mant, Keith Mant, who had been lecturing us about 6 times on forensic medicine at St. Mary's to my year group, qualifying in 1964. And Mant said that you must see the whole of the body. So when we went to the mortuary, the technician would wheel out, you know, they'd draw out the metal bier, so to speak, and then they would take the gown off the corpse so we could examine it. He might even turn it over. And the reason why Mant showed it, he showed a slide of someone who'd had the cremation certificate signed and passed, and when you took the gown off, there was ligature around the neck. It was concealed by the gown.
So if you want to turn the body over, is that a job for the mortician or for the doctor?
Mortician. The mortician will do that. You say, can I look at the back? Do you see? You see, things like this, you see, and it applies to the Kelly case as well. I can go into the detail of that. But I remember learning in Bristol when I was a senior health officer in a surgical rotation, a rather good job, because we could stay in one place for 2 years with our two children, that in South Africa, one of the ways of killing people silently in the armpit, you would be hard pushed to find this tiny puncture wound.
Well, if you lifted up your arm, you might even find somebody's number if they'd been in the SS. It would be tattooed on there.
Is that right? I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
If you ever saw any of those, David. But, I mean, we're talking here, really, aren't we, about a breakdown in law and order, I suppose.
Exactly.
So this is what happens if a nurse comes in and she's told, we'll just put this on the death certificate. And we spoke, didn't we, last year about the death of the Queen. In fact, I think it was 22.
Yes.
And about the suspicious circumstances around that death certificate, where the doctor had said on there, even though you're not allowed to put this, they'd said she died of old age.
I know, and it's happened recently. Here, in this parish, 300 yards from where I was sitting, a lady died. I won't mention her name now. She was quite elderly, but she was very sharp in her mind, a bit awkward of a personality, but she had a cancer. She'd been jabbed, she'd had the boosters as well, and I'm pretty sure she had a bone marrow cancer, the plasma cell tumour, in her spine. She called me in desperation because she wasn't getting any help from the practice. She was seen initially by a doctor, seen and examined. He said it's muscular. Her pain continued in her spine when she moved sharply, and she then had three telephone conversations about analgesia. You find this is happening. People are being advised to change, perhaps to up the dose or to have a more powerful analgesic, painkiller. And this is what was happening. So she called me after 3 weeks because she was in severe pain.
So this is about dealing with the symptom rather than the cause.
It's dealing in a mechanistic, remote way, arm's length way. It is not what doctors are about. Doctors should see a patient face to face, and when they examine a patient and put their hands on a patient, that actually helps the healing process. Patients feel lightened by having a doctor touch them. That helps. And they also help by having a doctor concentrate his whole attention on the patient. Sometimes in my clinics in the health service, people will say to me, "It's very easy talking to you, Mr. Halpin." So that's music to my ears, because I was listening to them. And in listening, you can make the diagnosis, like I said, in 2/3 of cases, without any blood tests or scans or the rest of it. Now, this lady... What was her death certificate? How was it signed? Remotely, I think. You know what it said? Frailty due to old age. If I put that down on death certificate, if I put down old age, when I did it once, actually, as a young doctor, probably in a hospital, probably as a house physician or house surgeon.
And that's really, you're saying, I don't know why this person's died.
They were very old and frail, which is what they said about the Queen, really, effectively. Mm. But the thing is that would not have been tolerated. The registrar of deaths would have phoned me up and said, "Mr. Hart, it happened to me. You cannot put that down. You have to have a diagnosis like bronchopneumonia." Now, my friend... house partner, friend of mine too, he died yesterday, probably with bronchopneumonia. But he had congestive cardiac failure, that would have been as well on the certificate, and probably also it may have been that he added a tumour. He was wasting to a degree. But we're dealing with a mechanistic, careless approach, and I say that to care is the most important characteristic of any worthwhile society. And to generalise, people care less. And I wanted to speak today briefly, Tony, about the fact that we have become inured to the fact that no one is accountable, no one is ever brought to the bar. I've been reading John Pilger's book. He wrote so much, as you know, and made about 70 films. He died about 6 months ago now. And sadly, he was sucked into the COVID thing as well. Did you know that? He was promoting it.
Okay, but before we talk about Pilger, let's just go back to the Queen for a moment, because it was very disingenuous, and in fact, it's a lie to say that she died of old age. She was being treated for something, quite clearly. She had marks on her arm that showed that she'd been being treated in some way.
She had had blood tests taken, hadn't she? She'd had blood taken. She had, I think, we discussed this. She had... bruising or something similar above her right wrist, and we imagine that she had some blood tests taken. She was being attended by a GP who they favoured in the Balmoral area. I forget his name now, but he signed the death certificate. But that certificate, which I think used the term old age, would not have been tolerated when I was a young doctor.
Well, it's another aspect to all of that. I mean, because I think there's something has to be said about all this, is the way that the a previous king, George the Fifth, I think it was, who was succeeded by Edward the Eighth, the Nazi king. He was his doctor. It was published, I think it was in the 1990s, in his doctor's memoirs. He made it quite clear. Well, Edward had encouraged me to dispatch him because he was a sort of in the way kind of character. He wasn't well.
You told me that.
He wasn't well. But this thing is known in the royal family that if there's an elderly royal that's in charge and the new kid on the block, in this case Prince Charles, now King Charles, comes along, it's not unheard of for them to just say, well, can you just get her out of the way?
Well, but I thought his appointment was very long delayed, wasn't it?
And how he has cancer, we have also spoken about the possible doubts over that. Yes. But he's now off to Samoa with cancer, and along with Camilla too. So I look at that whole business and think, well, look, you don't really like doing these public duties. The cancer is quite a handy cop out.
He doesn't look. He doesn't look to me like a chap with cancer. His daughter-in-law does.
Just by looking at somebody?
Well, yeah, I know. This is a broad brush. But he doesn't look to me like a man who's got a cancer.
Do people slow down, or what sort of signs?
Well, no, there's a colour about them. Do you know, I remember a German nurse who worked in Paint and Care Home, I think. She said to me, "Now you can smell cancer, Mr. Halpin." Now, I have a very poor sense of smell, but she said she could smell it. And I know why, too. Actually, I'll tell you that in a minute. But I know that dogs can smell cancer. Do you know that? They can. And the reason why you can smell cancer is that many tumours undergo necrosis, death, within the mass of the tumour. And that is like the smell of death, dead tissue. So that will be in the bloodstream and maybe even the sweat. So I, although I would like to know more about that, the chemistry of it, I can imagine that is true.
I mean, in a normal world, you might think that one of the first things in any kind of cancer diagnosis clinic would be a beagle sitting there ready to sniff you as you came in.
Yes, but the thing is that you see that all these things, the cart's put before the horse all the time. You say, now, people, do you know now they're talking about blood tests to detect cancer? Well, you can do that, you see. But I'll tell you one case. I had one of my many good mentors was Robin Ling up at Exeter. He, in fact, designed with an engineer the Exeter hip, which is used apparently in about a third of all cases worldwide. Robin had some urinary trouble. He had a thing called a PAS. Do you know what that stands for? Prostate-specific antigen. PSA, sorry, not PSA, not PS, PSA. It picks up in the blood test that the patient is making antigens against the tumour, prostate tumour. His was normal. So I think he was reassured. I can't remember the circumstances. But the fact is that he had a very active prostate cancer, what we call anaplastic. It was the cells would have been primitive. And it was growing fast, probably. But this doesn't produce the antigen which the blood test tests for. So there was a false, there was an aura of security when there wasn't. He ended up, in fact, with radiation to the prostate. That damaged his rectum. He had fecal frequency. And he ended up with an ileal loop. That is, they had to divert this large bowel into the ileum and bring it out in the front of his tummy. So, and he had a terribly rough time. Not treated very well at all, poor Robin.
Well, what make of this, one of the new, we hear on the news, the BBC raging about the idea of a new vaccine against cancer?
Ah, well, that raises the issue. It's a rather broad-ranging interview, this. But Fergus Walsh comes on. He's a rather rat-faced chap who comes on. He's a health correspondent or some similar title like that. He's always got some new thing to talk about. Usually there's been no proper controlled trial, and it's just distracting people with the idea that medicine has all sorts of clever tricks to help them, rather than getting your weight down or having nourishing food cooked at home rather than being a mini meal in some damn supermarket.
He seems to know how to read out a GlaxoSmithKline press release very well.
Ah, he made it. Is that so? Well, I'll tell you why. Do you know what his wife does? She was a GP. I think her name is Bernadette. She's a CEO or something like that in the Benelux countries for SmithKline French. And I wrote to him once saying, would you please announce your conflict of interest when you're talking about medical matters on the BBC? Of course, I get no reply from the BBC ever. That's why there's about 50 references to the BBC on my website, which is dhalpin.infoaction.org.uk. There's about 50 references to the health service, same number for community hospitals, same number for Dr. Kelly, who is yet to have an inquest 21 years after his unnatural death. That's a sign that we are living in a lawless country with lawless people running it, Sunak heading it up previously, and now a frank fascist running the so-called Labour government.
It's a sort of imperceptible swap over, isn't it? But we mentioned Kelly briefly. What about his inquest? It got stopped. What about basic things like an autopsy for the poor guy?
He had an autopsy by Dr. Nicholas Hunt. He was 9 years qualified as a doctor. He'd been 2 years on the Home Office pathology list, and he was called up from giving a lecture at Hampill or some name like that. It was the Police Federation place in Hampshire. He was called up from this place in Hampshire to conduct the examination of Kelly's body. He spent 7 hours in the process. He took the rectal temperature at the end of the seven-hour period, which I criticised, rather than early on, because the closer it is to death, more likely you can estimate the time of death.
Well, a professional, would be one of the first tasks.
I'm not sure. I don't know exactly that, but they usually have to slit in the trousers or take the they undress him anyway, eventually, to examine him at the scene in Harrowdown Woods. And he was conveyed to the John Radcliffe Infirmary, where Dr. Hunt, undertook the autopsy. The details of that were not released for some time, as you know, until years later, actually. But it was known at Radcliffe Infirmary that there were 9 police officers in the mortuary in attendance. That is most unusual. Usually there'd be the technician who takes the top of the head off and opens up the tummy, things like that. And usually there's, that's it actually, usually it's a pathologist and a technician. There might have been a stenographer, but he would use a tape machine to dictate it. But this is one of the points about the Kelly thing. Dr. Hunt dictated his summary of the autopsy and his conclusions about the cause of death that morning at the Radcliffe, I think it was a Saturday morning at Radcliffe Infirmary in the early hours. That post-mortem report has never been revealed. But the coroner who opened the inquest on the 21st of July, Kelly dying on the 17th or 18th of July, he wrote to Kelly saying, he wrote to Dr. Hunt saying that your opinion has changed, or something of that sort. You will obviously have to revise your post-mortem opinion.
Now, I know you believe that Kelly was actually murdered.
No, I don't know about that. He's had no inquest. It's highly likely he was assassinated, highly likely, particularly because of the way it was conducted.
I think maybe the British and the Americans do these assassinations in different ways. We just had the attempted assassination of Donald Trump within a whisker of actually taking the back of his skull off if he hadn't have turned just slightly to the right to look at some chart of migrants' crossings or whatever. But can you just give us in a nutshell why you think it's important to look at the Kelly case and to see this as a possible assassination?
Well, I can say that. Kelly's death was all about the Iraq War. The Iraq War was essentially a war for Israel. And I mean that. If you read the tract written in Hebrew, I don't read in Hebrew, but it was translated by Israel Shehak, an Israeli atheist, ex-Poland, a decent man by all accounts, but he translated a tract written by Oded Yinon in 1982. It's on my desktop, actually, and I quoted it yesterday as it happens. But in that tract, Yinon set out how every Arab entity or nation was to be dismantled, starting with Iraq. Syria was second. Libya was, I think, third. This was about the domination of our garrison, our aircraft carrier in the Middle East, set up by Britain in 1917. It was about them dominating, first of all, the Middle East.
Okay, those are circumstantial. What about clinical evidence?
Clinical evidence is zilch, pretty well. The cause of death was determined at the Hutton inquiry and was based entirely on the verdict, the opinion, written by Nicholas Hunt in his second post-mortem report.
So what do you think?
The first one was never revealed.
Okay, but what do you think? What do you think are the significant aspects of Kelly's body?
Kelly's body? Well, all sorts of things. In fact, when I talk about, I used to be asked to give talks on this, in fact, because it's a very important matter. He was our premier biological and chemical warfare expert, and he also had a knowledge of nuclear warfare as well. I think he was a moral man, from all accounts, and he was about to write a book. That was one thing that's never mentioned, actually. And he had, in fact, questioned in the autumn of 2002, when Campbell was altering the so-called dossier 17 times to make it more, inverted commas, sexy. Mm. But Kelly did, in fact, express an opinion then that, I think particularly about the 45-minute warning, you know, that way they use that. You remember that?
Oh, yeah, but I'm interested in what to do with his body made you initially think that this doesn't look like suicide to me.
Well, also many, many things. Partly because the main cause of death was exsanguination, bleeding out from a cut ulnar artery. This is a little artery which you can feel with difficulty on the little finger side of the wrist. You can feel a radial pulse quite easily. That's the one which most people go to and we're taught as doctors to feel. But the ulnar artery is partly concealed by a tendon. And but he'd cut that. We can talk about the method of the cutting, but you do not bleed to death from a cut ulnar artery. That's the fact of it.
So it's a myth. Someone who believed a myth had manufactured this situation.
Yes. Well, I think what was happened, it was a tableau was set up, because when Coe, interesting name actually there, but when Coe in his navy or black fatigues attended with one other person, he was named, there was a third person. That the name of that third person has never been revealed, but it's likely the third person was expert at setting up a tableau. And I think that they were content, they inverted commas, were content to leave it partly as a possible suicide and partly as a possible homicide. There are all sorts of incongruous things. When he was found by the searcher, two lay searchers were set out to look for this man who was missing. Oh, the whole thing stinks. God, she found him slumped against a tree. She noticed some dried blood on his wrist, and he was dead. They called the police, but I then learned, when the more you look at the records, and a lot of them are concealed now, or some of them concealed, the medical things, but one record I came across was a tape was put around by the police about 10 minutes after they got the call from this lay searcher. This is in a ruddy wood on top of a hill. I've been there with Miles Goslett. So there was foreknowledge, and I suspect that these lay searchers were probably told where to look for a start.
Okay, so the body was moved.
Body was moved. When the paramedics came, and they are the shining lights in this, the two paramedics, Bartlett and his lady assistant, when they came to the corpse, it was lying out, by the tree, and there was enough space for Mr. Bartlett to stand between the tree and the head of the corpse to apply, I think, unnecessarily electrodes for doing a cardiogram. Okay.
So what about the... You mentioned something with the cuts on his wrist being a bit peculiar.
Well, there were several cuts, and the pathologist Hunt talked about hesitation cuts. While we're speaking about Hunt, this was the most high-profile death in this country for decades, and there should have been a senior pathologist there, very experienced, with Hunt assisting. So Hunt was put in, and a little later on, he was warned by the GMC and had a 5-year warning applied to him, because in East Anglia he gave a talk to a partly lay audience and described corpses or something. I can't remember the details of it, but he had a warning from the GMC, which at the moment, of course, is siding particularly with the COVID nonsense and happy to crucify people like Adil.
So what about the cuts?
The cuts, there were several, but it is likely that they were made from... I'll show you with your wrist. If I was cutting my wrist like that with the right hand, he had difficulty using his right hand because he had an elbow injury from a horse riding accident years before, you would in fact take the knife and you would take it in your right hand, you'd have your wrist uppermost, your palm uppermost, your hand up, palm up, and you would cut from the thumb side to this side. It suggested the way the cuts were made, with difficulty, were made from the outside, as if the hand was picked up and cut like that.
But from someone actually standing slightly away from him,
possible. Yeah. But this sort of thing would be examined in a proper inquest.
So the idea is maybe he'd been given something to ingest that had killed him?
I think he was sedated. He left the house at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. His wife saw him on the phone beforehand. She didn't know what the conversation was about. I suspect he went for one of his usual... He liked going out for a walk when he was away from the MOD and places like that in London, you know, in Oxfordshire. Very nice, walking up the hill. But he went left at 3 o'clock. And the next thing we hear is that even before the body was examined and identity confirmed, the police were putting it out that there was a suicide. That's the fact of it. And that was in the morning, the next morning. The fact is that he left the house at 3 o'clock. The family, the daughters were called when he didn't come home. I think three daughters came, the twins and the one other. And they didn't inform the police that he was missing, even though there was a furore about this poor man, until 11 o'clock at night. Can you imagine?
Well, it might be that he decided, I might be a while, I'm going for a walk, you know. We don't really know.
But this is another thing, too. They could have proven that this was a suicide by looking at his cell phone records. The cell phones put out a signal every 20 seconds. There were antennae all over Oxfordshire. They could have triangulated that. They could have said the cell phone record showed that he went here, there. This was the time they could have shown he sat. They must have sat there for hours in Harrowdown Wood contemplating his suicide, if that was the fact.
I think it's interesting that there are other... I don't know, we've mentioned the Queen. We've mentioned David Kelly, which is much more evidence for foul play. Are there any other political... I mean, because we've got Diana is another one. What about...
whenever you read the ghastly press, they always speak of the death in the car accident of Princess Diana. There's no question that her death was planned.
Well, I'd certainly agree, and I would say anyone that doesn't believe that should have a read of the book How They Murdered Princess Diana. Mm-hmm. That's by John Morgan.
Well, I had corresponded with John Morgan, and his wife, Lana, she wrote to me because she knew I was interested in the death of Kelly. And she was, and of course her husband had spent... Most remarkable man, actually, John Morgan. He was able to speak, as you know, with the MI6 people like that, and got out a lot of truth about it.
Well, there was Richard Tomlinson from MI6 that swore an affidavit that he'd actually seen the plan that was used on Diana while he was MI6. It had actually been considered for using it on Slobodan Milosevic to kill him in a tunnel with a bright flash of light and some method of making the speeding cars front steering wheels suddenly turn to the side, causing a crash. But anyway, you mentioned briefly there Robin Cook.
I did. Well, Robin Cook's death, we looked into that, and I've discussed it before with you, haven't I think. But there's no question that he was, it is highly likely that it was an assassination.
Why?
Well, I know his GP, and his GP said he was a fit man. And when he went to the memorial service, he could not help but look at the people who were attending in all solemnity and think how many of you or who was involved in the command to deal with Robin Cook.
He was apparently had some sort of cardiac issue whilst... Yes. Climbing Ben Stack Mountain. A helicopter came and picked him up, but it refused to take his wife at this time with him in the helicopter, which was a bit strange in itself. And then, of course, when he arrives, a bit like Diana, it's almost like the ambulance of death.
Well, in Diana's case, I think it was 1 hour and 50 minutes between the accident in Alma Tunnel and her arriving at an inappropriate hospital.
Anyway, you wanted to talk about John Pilger, and you wanted to talk about the, the sort of breakdown
in talking about. You see, what is extraordinary, if you think of the death of Diana, the evidence is strong that she was, in fact, murdered, in a rather complicated way, but that does not emerge in the public consciousness. A lot of people will suspect it. In Kelly's case, people know there's a stink. It's amazing how many people still feel it.
There is the Keith Allen film Unlawful Killing, which does, you know, this is a inquest verdict when they finally had the coroner's inquest, which was, I think, the royal family were on their third or fourth coroner by the time that they managed to get the coroner to agree to conduct the inquest. So if unlawful killing is, it certainly wasn't an accident.
No.
That hasn't sunk in, maybe.
No, it hasn't sunk in, but you see, in this book of John Pilger's, which Joe gave me some while ago, it's called The New Rulers of the World. And there's four sections, and the second one is about Iraq in 2002. Pilger's a remarkable journalist, the amount of people interviewed. When you read it, it is sickening. It is sickening. The killing of perhaps 500,000 children. And the people who are responsible, have never been held to account.
So where's this?
What? Where? What?
Where?
Where? This is in Iraq. This is Gulf War I and the sequel.
Well, the sanctions
pursued by the so-called Security Council, but in fact there's no substance to that anyway. And the whole kaboosh, the Security Council, is an utterly lawless setup anyway, as you know. In fact, they're there, the five permanent members, because they're nuclear powers.
Well, I think the Russians are now chairing the UN Security Council. Yeah, I think so.
What are they doing?
Well, they're trying, but of course everything gets vetoed by the United States.
Well, look at this. This is a quote from this section, the heading. This is Brigadier General William Looney. Interesting. I think of O'Looney, who's been so honest about, so good about, funeral director, who's spoken about the COVID, what he saw very early on. This is the quote. They know we own their country. This is Iraq. We dictate the way they live and talk. And that's what's great about America right now. It's a good thing, especially when there's a lot of oil there out there we need. This is one of their force members. And the thing is that what we've seen since World War II, US has bombed, often with our assistance, sometimes intelligence, as in Cambodia. MI6 apparently was helping them there. MI6 is helping them in Gaza.
The Lancet last week talked about up to 186,000 people killed in Gaza.
Yes, that's right. Four times as many. They're recording about 36,000, but it's a very incomplete toll because a lot of people are dying of disease, of dehydration, of dysentery.
Polio this week.
Well, they're talking about polio. But the thing is that it will be underreported, we know that. And there's about 11,000 missing under the rubble. So you can imagine the stinking corpses, what they might find eventually.
Do you think The Lancet publishing some estimate like this, that doctors see that they take it seriously?
No, I don't. I don't. On Kelly, I've had met colleagues who said, oh, he was bumped off. They say it with a smile. Quite extraordinary how some people are.
And it's sometimes it's the only way to deal with it, isn't what? It? Isn't it the only way?
No. I think anyone should feel...
At least they're not denying it.
They're not denying it. But the Lancet's Lancet, to be quite frank, has in fact tainted its image already. You will probably know about the hydroxychloroquine investigation. They had to withdraw the paper. It was they'd use toxic doses in this trial. And that's not good medical journalism. I know a lot about medical journalism because I was on the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery for 4 years on editorial board, and I know about plagiarism. I know how many medical papers are not flawless.
So, look, can we wind up by saying something about...
Yes. I like to say this, that unless we bring criminals to account in our own domestic circumstances and have them tried fairly, and the justice system is in free fall at the moment in this country, but unless we bring war criminals to account, it goes on and on and on. The killing of dear children, the killing of mummies. One of the things I keep saying is that no mother and child should be in the least harmed anywhere in our still beautiful world.
Well, even in this country, you and I in our lifetime have seen things turned upside down.
It's upside down. The thing is that, like I said in my letter to the Attorney General, it's published on my website on Monday. It's posted there. I say at the end of it, I revere the law. And it's quite obvious the politicians we've had for years in this country revere no law. They've killed people abroad, right, left and centre. And I weep for the people that we've killed.
So where is the light at the end of the tunnel?
There's no light at the moment. The only light should come with proper information, first of all. There's no proper information. And the second thing comes from people caring more. They don't care too much. They're thinking about the next click and collect.
Well, I was thinking just the other day, meeting some Palestinians and just getting the sense from them that these guys are winners. It's almost like speaking to, say, the French resistance in the Second World War.
They are the most remarkable people. I know them well. They're a noble people. They're ingenious. They're industrious. They're all smeared all round, as you know. But they're making the ultimate sacrifice to show the world what is truth and what is evil. It is the ultimate sacrifice, and they know they're making it. Sue sends money to an account in this country, which has access to a friend of ours in Gaza now. And we have a message from him. The other day he wrote the last thing, in fact it's now published on my Dove and Dolphin website. I can't remember the dead title for that. But in that he said they're shelling us all round here in the middle of Gaza. He went on to say that my friend, a doctor, Dr. Hamis, he said, is well. But he'll be in the same circumstances. But they know that their resistance fighters there, very small proportion of the population, are, as guerrillas, doing their very best to resist the Israeli occupation. But the worry, of course, Tony, is that Hezbollah may start to respond more massively, and they can do that, particularly after they set fire, the Israelis, to the oil depot at Hodeidah.
I think the positive thing for me is it's almost as if however much evil the Americans, the British and the Israelis shower down on the people of Gaza, the people who are doing the evil, just as in the Second World War, they're losers. They can't galvanise public support from those sorts of actions. And so ultimately they may win the battle but lose the war.
They are losing, and they're losing, of course, because... We talk about PTSD. I've said for a long time, were there many people who came back from fighting the Nazis with PTSD? No. The reason why they come back from from Ghan, as they called it, from Libya. Look at my paper on my website, the buzzard, the cuckoo. I've kept the full title at you now, but it ends with the celebrations they had in Plymouth when the warships came back, the submarines that had been sending cruise missiles to Sirte to kill over 60,000 civilians in Sirte, where Saddam came from originally. What's the president that they killed? That I think our lot were involved in that, weren't they? The president of Libya.
Oh, Gaddafi.
Sirte. But Sirte, they were firing cruise missiles from submarines in the Mediterranean. They were in no danger whatsoever, but their return to Plymouth was celebrated in a big way. You know, they line up on the foredecks, all the balloons go up and what have you. It is nauseating, but I've recorded it from the MOD website in that particular article. It's a good article, actually.
Well, there is some sort of hope, even if, you know,
the
there isn't.
Is that people are waking up. I find this, and the people who wake up are the common man and woman. The middle classes remain complacent, largely. The academics are mostly useless. Up their backsides, they think they know it all, they know nothing. But I think that most people down the sharp end, who know that they've been done down by governments time after time in all sorts of ways, they know there's a, like my webmaster says, they know there's a smell, and now they know there's a stink.
Your website, finally, can you just remind us of the site again?
dhalpin.infoaction.org.uk, dhalpin.infoaction.org.uk. It's full from top to bottom. It was set up in 2006, and I'm so grateful for Bill Stevens that he set it up. And that came from a lovely artist chap in Totnes called Neville.
David Halpin, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Tony.